Well, undoubtedly he didn't have much else to go on, so he put all of his eggs in the Second Amendment basket, and he appealed there. I'm sure, I bet the NRA wishes that they could have found a little bit more compelling person to bring this particular case. You know, the good work by a federal public defender here, undoubtedly, bringing this case forward. The argument was that, well, this violates the Second Amendment. It says right of the people to keep and bear arms. It doesn't say the right of the people who are not potheads to keep and bear arms. It says the people. So this violates the Second Amendment. He was just keeping and bearing arms. Well, the court took a hard look at that. They did affirm the conviction. Like I say, this is a pretty new area of the law, so it's pretty much up in the air, even simple things like what is the standard of review? You know, how do we judge the statute? You know, is it rational basis? Is it strict scrutiny? Well, the court didn't answer that question, and it pointed out that the Supreme Court has yet to answer that question of what exactly, in general, the standard of review is for looking at statutes like this. But they had to define it, obviously, for this particular case. And the standard that they came up with, I don't know if these words really mean anything, but this is the standard that they used. It has to be more than merely rational. So it's not just, did Congress have a rational basis for keeping guns away from users of drugs? So it has to be a little bit higher than that. They didn't go out and say what it really is, but they said it has to withstand some form of strong showing. They didn't say exactly what that form of strong showing is. But they said that they are not waiting, and nor did the Supreme Court want to wade into the levels of scrutiny quagmire. Well, that quagmire is out there, and that's going to be waded into by courts in upcoming cases, I'm sure. So it'll be an interesting few years on some of these cases to see what standard of review does come out of these. But in this case, it has to be some form of strong showing, the court said. And a little bit more particularity, whether the government has made a strong showing that the challenge statute was substantially related to an important government objective. So some of those words are words that have been used before in other constitutional law contexts. So I guess there is a little bit of a standard starting to evolve. And that's what the standard is that substantially related to an important government objective. But the court said that perhaps, and it'll have to wait for a later case, the question of whether a different kind of firearm regulation might require a different approach. So this is still very much open. The court said that this regulation was valid. Again, not too hard to do. The litigant there is not a very compelling person. He was not some hunter out lawfully hunting, or he was not somebody with any kind of need for security in his home. He was just some punk out walking around with a loaded gun and some marijuana. So probably not the kind of person that the NRA would hold up as their quintessential law-abiding citizen. And here they held that the regulation was valid. And they said that the purpose of this kind of statute is to keep guns out of the hands of presumptively risky people. And, you know, from the brief description of this defendant, he does sound like probably he is a presumptively risky person. The court analogized this to other kinds of cases, such as criminals, juveniles without the consent of their parents or guardians, narcotic addicts, mental defectives, armed groups who would supplant duly constituted public authority, and others whose possession of firearms is similarly contrary to the public interest. He said that this person, this regular user of drugs, of marijuana, fits in that category of a presumptively risky person. And they said it's analogous to a disarming felons. Well, kind of anticipating some of the area. Well, just because the guy smokes a little bit of pot doesn't mean he's necessarily a dangerous person. Well, that's why they analogized it to the cases of felons. Because a felon can't possess a firearm, and it doesn't matter whether you are a dangerous felon, a violent felon, or some kind of white-collar felon. In fact, I like the title of one of the Law Review articles that they cited as part of this, and that was, "Why Can't Martha Stewart Have a Gun?" You know, Martha Stewart, she lied to the FBI about some insider trading. You know, she's probably not going to go on a shooting rampage or anything like that, but she is not allowed to have a gun. And, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere, and Congress chose to draw the line at if you're a felon. Not necessarily a violent felon or anything like that, but simply if you're a felon, you can't possess a firearm. And here, too, the line has to be drawn somewhere. So here, this regular user of marijuana, he is within the line that's not allowed to possess firearms. And he can't argue that in his particular case, it shouldn't apply or something like that. Therefore, the government did indeed make this strong showing that it was related to the government objective. Interesting to note, the court said, well, this guy's really better off than the felon or somebody who's been committed to a mental institution. Because if you're a felon, there's nothing that you can do to get back your right to possess firearms. You know, that's external to you, you know. But here, the unlawful drug user can regain his right to possess a firearm simply by ending his drug abuse. So here, this poor Mr. Yancey, instead of when he was picked up and said, yeah, that's my pot, I smoke it every day, it would have been a different case if he would have said, oh yeah, that was my pot, I used to smoke it every day, but I stopped this morning. Then it would be a different case, presumably, because he's no longer a user of illegal drugs. But that's not what he said, and I guess probably actually having it in your pocket probably didn't help his case too much. But if he had given it up the day before, then presumably he would not have been convicted. But he was. This case does raise a couple of interesting things. Because as you see, it's a case of possession of a firearm. And again, this particular guy is not particularly sympathetic. But it does show, I think, that a lot of these firearms do contain a lot of pitfalls and traps for the unwary, and they're difficult to navigate sometimes. And here, again, the guy jumps immediately to his constitutional defense. And, you know, that's all he's resting his case on, is that, no, under the Constitution, I'm entitled to possess a gun. Well, in his case, like I say, it's not particularly compelling. But if somebody comes in to your office and says, you know, I was convicted 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or, you know, I was in some trouble way back then, and, you know, I like going hunting. Can I still go hunting because of that thing that happened 20 years ago? And I'm very uncomfortable answering those kinds of questions because there are so many traps for the unwary. Because in some circumstances, in some cases, somebody will, and in some states, because it'll vary, because whether or not you are a felon for purposes of federal law is determined by state law. So you have to look at the state of the underlying conviction. And some of those questions get very murky of, are you still a felon? You know, because some states seem to have almost a once a felon, always a felon. If you're convicted of a felony when you're 19 years old, you're still a felon when you're 65 years old and you can't possess a gun. Some states are considerably more liberal about that. But it varies a lot from state to state, and there are a lot of traps for the unwary. So, I mean, personally, I feel very uncomfortable answering those kinds of questions. And it is a situation where, probably not in this case, but in some of these cases, you know, you have a person who wants to go out and engage in something that would otherwise be perfectly lawful activity for most of the population. You know, go hunting with a rifle or a shotgun. But there's a very fine line when that lawful behavior becomes a serious federal felony. And here, I don't know what his criminal history was. The sentence was 21 months. So it's the kind of offense that even with a reasonably low criminal history score, there's going to be some federal prison time. So these laws, you have to be careful. And if you have somebody present questions like that, you know, my off-the-cuff answer would be, oh no, that was 30 years ago, don't worry about it. Well, no, I'm not comfortable saying that. And I'm frankly not comfortable navigating some of these statutes myself. So I think those are the kinds of cases where that question really ought to be answered by a specialist. And especially because there's no defense of relying in good faith on your counsel. Now, in fact, today, I believe, is the opening of bow hunting season in Minnesota. One of the little secrets, I think, of the outdoors people is that one of the reasons why bow hunting is a pretty popular activity is because there are quite a few people who like hunting who are not allowed to own guns because of something they did 30 years ago. So I think that might have something to do with why bow hunting is so popular today. Well, we'll leaving the constitutional law cases, moving on to something else, antitrust and fair trade laws, Flying J versus Van Hollen. This is an interesting case because it's under the Wisconsin Unfair Sales Act. The Wisconsin Unfair Sales Act was a 1939 law that mandates minimum markups for various things. It's been amended throughout the years. It used to apply to a lot of stuff. Now it doesn't apply to very much, but one of the things it does apply to is gasoline. So in Wisconsin, and this is true in many states, including Minnesota, there are laws about how cheap you can sell your gasoline. In Minnesota, there are laws about how cheap you can sell your milk. There are minimum markups. You know, I bet if you go to Stillwater Prison and ask some of the men there, you know, what you in for? I bet a lot of them will say selling milk below cost. Or at least many of them probably got their start in a life of crime with that. It's a serious matter, especially here in some of the populous states like Minnesota and Wisconsin, selling things below cost. Why do we have these statutes? Well, the Wisconsin Act here dates to 1939.